You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Hello. Just before I jump into this first interview of the legal term, a bit of housekeeping. You may notice that the music is different. We have a new producer, Philip Lacker, who will be guiding all our forthcoming episodes of LawPod UK into the world. And the introduction and valediction to all forthcoming episodes is the voice of our very own Richard Booth QC, head of One Crown Office Row. Now, turning to my guest today, Angus McCulloch QC is a barrister at One Crown Office Row with experience of acting as a special advocate in closed proceedings since 2002. He has recently participated in a submission to the Independent Reviewer, submissions also made by security-cleared barristers like him who appear in secret proceedings. Angus, welcome on board LawPod UK.
Thanks, Rosalind, and thank you for asking me.
So, Angus, these secret proceedings, closed material proceedings, or we're going to call them CMPs in this interview, were introduced in order to enable the government to rely on secret material in legal proceedings. Then in 2013, as I understand, Parliament provided for CMPs to be available in the full range of civil proceedings, and this was done through the Justice and Security Act 2013. Incidentally, the names of all these acts and cases when referred to will be on the post accompanying this interview on the UK Human Rights blog, so I'll give full citations and details. Angus, there are certain safeguards included in this act, weren't there?
Yes, that's right. The act, as it was passing through Parliament, it initially appeared as a green paper and generated a degree of debate. And then the bill which followed it was also controversial. And as it was passing through Parliament, a number of amendments to the original proposals were made. And these included safeguards which provided for annual reports as to the use of the closed procedures under the Act to be submitted by the government. And after the Act had been in force for 5 years, for the closed material procedures under the Act to be reviewed. And that 5-year anniversary passed in June 2018. So those were two of the safeguards that the government, well, the Parliament, I should say, required of the government in passing this legislation.
Before we get into the weeds of this review, this rather belated review, let's take a few steps back and look at why, indeed, how CMPs were needed in the first place.
Yes, well, why? In short, the merit of CMPs is that it enables the state to rely on secret evidence in legal proceedings. And the traditional way in which secret evidence was dealt with was through the well-established public interest immunity procedures. And the disadvantage of PII, as it's generally abbreviated to, was that if a PII application by the government was successful, then the evidence, relevant evidence, would be excluded from consideration by the court. Now, that preserved the sanctity of a fundamental principle of the fairness of proceedings, that each party should know of the evidence that the other party is producing, and so complied with natural justice, but obviously in certain circumstances was capable of causing difficulties if centrally relevant evidence was excluded from the consideration of the court, so undermining the fairness of the proceedings. And that, at least, is the theoretical justification. In practice, I think it's fair to say that PII had been operated quite imaginatively and flexibly. So it had been relatively rare. There's one famous case, Carnduff and Rock, in which the court had held that it wasn't possible to have fair proceedings, having applied the PII mechanism. And so the claim was dismissed. That, I should say, was not a national security case, but it was held up as an example of the shortcomings of PII in these difficult cases where sensitive material may be involved. So the response to the what were perceived as the shortcomings of PII was the introduction of closed material procedures. Now, these first came in 1997, specifically in the context of immigration cases. So the Special Immigration Appeals Commission was formed and CMPs came into existence in this jurisdiction. And the central feature of a CMP, as we know it in this country, is the appointment of a special advocate. And the special advocate has a role in seeing the secret material, so is cleared by the government to the necessary level to see secret sensitive material. And he or she has two functions in relation to that. The first is to see whether it can in fact be put into open, disclosed to the open representatives in a way which doesn't compromise national security, or in a form which is gisted that preserves the concerns about sensitivity, but enables the substance of it to be disclosed. And the second function is that in relation to the material that remains enclosed, to act in the other party, the excluded party's interests in challenging, probing, analysing that material in the way that it's judged to be in the interests of the excluded party. So that, in essence, is the closed material procedure. And as I say, as originally enacted, was restricted to the immigration context. Since then, the scope of them has mushroomed from the original proceedings in SIAC in 1997. They were extended to a range of rather specialist tribunals in a variety of circumstances, but remained rather restricted in their use. And then the sea change came in 2013 when the Justice and Security Act was passed, which made CMPs available to be implemented in the full range of civil proceedings across all the nations of the United Kingdom.
When one thinks of closed material proceedings, one immediately thinks of immigration, deportation, terrorism-related proceedings. And as I understand it, one of the arguments of the government saying that we need these special proceedings is that otherwise we can't disclose evidence and we have to expensively settle a lot of cases. But that seems to be still the case. Is that not true?
Well, that's interesting. And that will no doubt be part of the consideration of the review on the basis of an overview of all the cases that have been brought in which the CMPs under the 2013 Act have been invoked. But in my role as one of the special advocates making a submission to the reviewer that you referred to in your opening, we were assisted by the Special Advocate Support Office, who, as the name suggests, provide a crucial administrative role in relation to supporting special advocates in these closed proceedings. And they compiled from their own records, a list of cases that they were aware of in which these procedures have been used. And the striking thing from that list, which emerged, was that as far as private law claims are concerned, there was no example that could be identified of a case in which the government had fought to trial a civil claim in private law against them. There are plenty of examples of judicial review claims which have been fought to trial. But as far as the private law claims are concerned, one or two have been withdrawn along the way. But we can't identify any claim in which the government has fought it to trial. They seem to have chosen to settle the claims, usually on confidential terms. And so one of the prime justifications that was advanced at the time that the JSA was going through Parliament, which was that it would enable the government to fight cases which it would otherwise settle, doesn't appear to have been borne out in practice. With the ancillary concern, perhaps, that in some of these cases, they do involve allegations of the most serious nature. And so the judicial processes have not operated to the end point of judicial determinations of the issues and allegations raised in such cases.
Yes, well, I mean, clearly it's important that important cases should crystallise in a judgment that creates a precedent, preventing more suits against the government.
Yes, I mean, the obviously there will be legal points which maybe arise in a series of cases in a similar context, but many of these cases may actually turn on their own facts. And if the government chooses to settle them and the parties are prepared to come to terms, then there's nothing one can do about that, however much the broader public may have an interest in knowing the outcome that would be reached if there was a judicial determination.
So, Angus, just going into the work that you're doing and have done for so long, what would you say are the day-to-day operational problems that you encounter with CMPs?
One of the features of all CMPs, both under the JSA and the other statutory regimes, is that special advocates are prohibited from communicating directly with the party or their representative whose interests they are appointed to represent and promote. And one can understand the basic rationale for that, which is that it is to guard against inadvertent disclosure of material that may be damaging. But in practice, the absolute prohibition on communication leads to some significant administrative difficulties when, on entirely mundane logistical aspects to promote the effective running of the case and cooperation between the parties, it's not possible to communicate directly with the other parties involved, even where the government body is copied into the communication. So it tends to lead, in some circumstances, to frustrating inefficiencies in the system for no, as it appears to us, no very good reason, because there's no national security risk when one's talking about the dates of availability for listing of a hearing or such like purely procedural matters.
Procedural matters such as that. Yes, I see that.
So that's one inherent problem. I think in practice, we have a concern, and it's articulated in the submission that we've made to the reviewer, that there are significant shortcomings and have been over various periods since the Act came into force as to the level of resourcing and support that special advocates have received. And there's a somewhat anomalous position in that SASO, that I referred to earlier, the Special Advocate Support Office, is a team within the government legal department. Now, in practice, the SASO is staffed by very professional, highly skilled government lawyers that we as special advocates have no doubt are supporting us fully and effectively, notwithstanding the fact that they happen to sit within the government legal department that tends to be employing the representatives on the other side. But in terms of resourcing, we have had really serious issues with a lack of resources being applied to staff, to SASO and the staffing levels, which on occasion have compromised the ability of special advocates to discharge their functions in what is already, as one can imagine, a pretty demanding and challenging role. Two other concerns are that at the time the JSA was being passed through Parliament and the government was anxious to reassure Parliament and the public that the fairness of these CMPs would be enhanced. And they indicated that they would be enhanced by making training for special advocates more widely available and improving the training that was available. And secondly, to create a database of closed judgments. And one of the issues and concerns with these proceedings is that the law is not accessible. Is not accessible even to those of us who are operating on the far side of the curtain. There's no reason for us to know of other cases in which similar points may have arisen other than by relying on happenstance and fortune. So the proposal was that there would be a closed judgment database available to special advocates, and that simply hasn't materialized. Nor, I should say, has been the improved training. And in fact, if anything, the training that was previously available has almost entirely disappeared for most of the period under review, the 5-year period following the passage of the JSA. So we do have serious concerns about the operation of CMPs under the JSA and more generally, and the government's failure to honour the commitments that they made at the time that the JSA was being passed.
This may be just a detail, but I was interested to read about the so-called tainting issue. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, that arises where the open representatives wish to appoint a particular special advocate or wish for a particular special advocate to be appointed. And there is a process which has become known as tainting checks, whereby the government looks at the previous cases that that individual has been involved with and considers whether there is a risk in the light of the material that they will have seen in those previous cases of inadvertent disclosure in communications with the open representatives. And if there is such exposure, then the government will raise an objection and say that special advocate is tainted. And so what usually occurs, and I should go back to when I said the special advocate can't communicate with the open representatives, that applies from the point that the special advocate receives the closed secret material. Prior to that, subject to the tainting, the special advocate can communicate with the open representatives, but obviously doesn't know the material which is going to be relevant to their role. It is nonetheless useful to have that contact, that communication, those discussions before receiving the secret material. But all of that open communication may not be possible if the government raises a so-called tainting objection in relation to that particular special advocate, which leaves the open representatives with the choice of appointing a different special advocate that is not tainted because they haven't been exposed to any material which gives rise to that concern, or proceeding with their chosen special advocate but being deprived of the opportunity to have those open discussions before receipt of the closed material by the special advocate.
It's all very difficult. How many of there are you in the country?
Well, that's an interesting question that's not very easy to give a precise answer to. And the reason for that is that there are a number of special advocates who have been approved and appointed to the list of special advocates, so are available to be appointed on specific cases, but haven't actually done any cases, haven't acted in the role. And then there are special advocates who are not only on the list, but do have experience of one or more, and maybe a lot more, cases performing it. I think to give a more precise answer, by way of indication at least, in terms of the special advocates with experience of closed procedures under the JSA, there are some 35 or so, I think, who have some experience of them. And among those number are both Northern Irish special advocates and special advocates at the English Bar, with an overlap between the two because some of us are called in both jurisdictions. The precise number is, I think 37, because there are 33 signatories to the submission, which consists of every special advocate that hasn't been appointed as a High Court judge, because four of us over the course of the life of the JSA have been appointed to the High Court bench and they played no part in the submission. But every single other special advocate, as far as we are aware, has contributed to and subscribed to the submission to the reviewer that we made in early June of this year.
And you actually mentioned Northern Ireland. I wanted to come on to that. There are particular problems relating to CMPs in proceedings in Northern Ireland. Can you describe those to us?
Yes, there are quite a number of cases under the JSA in Northern Ireland. They're largely, but not entirely, private law claims. And the difficulty that I and others who have been practicing in the jurisdiction encounter arise from the fact that there are no facilities, no dedicated facilities for special advocates to work on closed material. And we set this out in our submission, but it leads to real problems in there being no office, dedicated computer facilities and so on to enable special advocates to work on closed material. A second difficulty is that SASO, again referring to the Special Advocate Support Office, is based in London and has no office, no facilities, no personnel based in Belfast, which creates real administrative difficulties on occasion in them having to cover both bases, but with only an office in London. And I think the third difficulty is that whereas in England and Wales, a procedure has been derived which enables indirect communication, which is what special advocates are restricted to in the light of the communication bar I described earlier. The basic effect of the communication bar is that any communication from a special advocate to the open representatives must be cleared by the government or the court or approved by the court. The problem with that is that what would ordinarily be confidential or quasi-privileged communications are having to go through the litigation team that are on the other side. So one's deprived of that confidential means of communication. And to address that in England and Wales, the so-called, it's not entirely accurately labelled, but LPP route, legal professional privilege route, has been devised, whereby the communication can be cleared not by the team with conduct of the litigation or their clients, but someone independent, but within government, who regards it as confidential, reviews it for the purposes of clearing it for passing to the open representatives, having been able to satisfy themselves that there is no national security risk to the communication. So there is a route, the so-called LPP route, whereby special advocates can communicate to the open representatives without suffering the disadvantage of such a communication, which may involve tactical considerations or a review of the prospects, sort of thing you wouldn't want the other party in contested litigation to have access to. So we've got that in England and Wales, but it has not been devised in Northern Ireland. No equivalent route has been devised in Northern Ireland, and that is a concern and a frustration.
As it works to a certain extent in England and Wales, why it hasn't. But, yes, talking about confidentiality and needing to be cleared, I mean, you've kindly agreed, and thinking about your freedom of expression, Angus, you've kindly agreed to do this interview, but there could have been problems even with this podcast in terms of clearance.
Yes, it's something that has become a recent concern on the part of special advocates, that there seems to be a level of obstruction being placed in our contribution to public debate and discussion about closed procedures. And historically, and ever since I've been a special advocate, I and other special advocates have had a wide-ranging contribution to the public debate. Of course, recognizing that we cannot discuss specific cases that we've been involved with because of the risk of disclosure, even if inadvertently, as it would obviously be. But in terms of the general processes, concerns, difficulties, and justification for closed procedures, we've had a free hand in contributing in a variety of forums. I've given evidence, and other special advocates have, to a variety of parliamentary committees, to NGOs, to public discussions in organisations like the Administrative Law Bar Association, and so on. And very recently, and in particular in the context of this review, the objections have been raised to special advocates participating in such discussions. And this arose in particular, and we set it out in our submission to the reviewer, as it seemed a relevant concern, we were invited, I and a number of special advocates were invited to participate in a discussion with the well-known NGO Justice, who had an interest in contributing to the review, and were told that that was objected to. Now, my practice, and I think that of other special advocates, has always been in advance of any such discussion to indicate that we were proposing to engage in it, so that there's no question of us having covert discussions or anything that wasn't entirely above board. So it's always seemed sensible and appropriate to say in advance, I'm proposing to participate in this discussion. And as I say, hitherto, there's never been an objection. So it was a surprise when the objection was raised in May of this year to our participation in the discussion with Justice. And we're awaiting a full explanation in relation to that. But I'm pleased to say that I was given clearance to participate in this podcast. So here I am, and an objection hasn't been raised. It remains to be seen for the future, and is a residual concern as to degree to which objection will be made to special advocates participating in such discussion. For my own part, I think it is very important that special advocates should be able to participate in public discussion of CMPs. They are an extraordinary procedure. They do give rise to concerns. There is a level of inherent of unfairness that is inherent to them, and we should all be working, government, special advocates, and more widely, to minimise that unfairness and ensure that they work as effectively as they and efficiently as they can. For those with an interest in some of the underlying detail, I can point out that the paper that I've referred to on a number of occasions that was submitted to the reviewer is publicly available. It's linked to a web post that I produced on the UK Human Rights blog called Secret Justice, An Insider's View. It can be downloaded there, as well as the case list of cases that have taken place in which an application under Section 6 of the JSA has been made, an application for a closed material procedure. So that's where more detail is to be found. A lot of these issues are explored in much greater detail there, if anyone has interest in seeing that.
And I will, of course, refer to those two posts of yours in my post that will accompany this podcast when it goes out. So, Angus, thank you very much for overcoming certain hurdles in terms of discussing all this in public, and I'm sure there'll be a great deal of interest in the subject. So very good to have you on LawPod UK, and hope to see you again here soon.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row.